You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 137 is something like, how do our tastes reflect our social position? And we read Distinction, a Social Critique of the Judgment of Taste by Pierre Bourdieu from 1979. That is the introduction, chapter 1 through page 63, and the conclusion and postscript. You can join the discussion, get the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Lintonmeyer, getting high and mighty on my educational capital in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, making excuses for why I cannot adequately consume high culture art in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Alwyn, demanding to be approached with a specifically aesthetic intention in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Tim Quirk, feeling partially responsible in Oakland, California.
Welcome, Tim.
Hey, Tim.
A returning guest of sorts.
Yeah, like I said, I think this is my fault.
Say why.
Because I mentioned this treatise in an aside when Mark was interviewing me for his other podcast, and somehow or other, even though I have no real qualification to be having this conversation, I am now here.
Well, that has never stopped us before.
I was just going to say, welcome to the club.
But you had read this. What was the circumstances in which you put yourself through this long ago?
Oh, man. Well, I'll try to tell a very short version of the story. I had given a presentation at a thing called the Pop Conference, which is one of my favorite events ever. It takes place, it's taken place at various venues, but mostly at the Experience Music Project in Seattle. It's structured like an academic conference in that you have to submit an abstract and a selection committee chooses if you're going to be able to present at it. But it's open not just to academics, it's open to anybody who thinks critically about music for a living. So you get this really nice cross-section of academics and music journalists and just sometimes performers themselves all getting together to talk about music. And usually there's like some sort of topic for the year.
And you were a performer before, and then at that point you were working already in the electronic music industry or...
In the online music industry, yes. I was running the editorial team at Rhapsody, an online music subscription service. And so this particular year, I was giving a presentation basically with a lot of data about how I saw on-demand music streaming services as they became more mainstream, how they might change listening habits and musical tastes. And while it tried to be a very data-centric presentation, I would say it was slightly controversial, mostly because the examples I was using, for reasons both of my own taste and of that's what the data was showing, tended to be white guitar-driven bands. Not exclusively, but there was a preponderance of them. And also, I think in retrospect, my paper had what I thought at the time was an amusing title, but turned out to be rather controversial. It was called Good News for Yola Tango. And the hypothesis of the piece was that I had been in a cult indie rock band myself, and so the hypothesis of my piece was that in the future, when you move to an on-demand listening world, you can get paid not just for how many people like your music, but how much individual people like your music. The more often you get listened to, the more money you make. And so you could be a Yola Tango who maybe only has, 50,000 fans, 100,000 fans, but if they each listen to you 10,000 times, that's as good as having, a million fans who each listen to you once, right? That was sort of the thrust of the piece. But because I was extolling not necessarily the virtues of this type of music, but saying this type of music had a different future than it had had a past, in the midst of, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the term poptimism, but in music journalist world, there's been a change in the last decade or more. There's this movement called poptimism, which basically posits that in the olden days, in the 80s and 90s, music critics tended to valorize indie rock at the expense of ignoring mainstream culture. And so now you're supposed to pay much more attention and value the top 40 as much as you do, or as much as we used to, Yola Tango. So for all of those reasons, during the Q&A after my paper, there was this very palpable negative current from the assembled critics, right? And so a friend of mine who was an academic, I was sort of talking to her afterwards, and I was vaguely accused of being a racist because of this, which was, never a fun thing. And so she gave me two books at the end of it, and she said, look, you're just not familiar with, the current thought process and, the literature you're supposed to have read to be having these conversations. And she gave me a book called White Privilege, and she gave me this book, Distinction.
What were the grounds for accusing you of racism?
Well, again, nobody specifically said that, but what they did say is this presentation would be a lot more interesting if you were using some more African-American artists as your examples, rather than the Yo La Tengos of the world and the Wilcos of the world. Nobody explicitly said you're a racist. They just said, hey, you're painting a grim future. My point was, I'm not making an aesthetic value judgment about this music. I'm just saying music with fewer fans has a more economically lucrative future than it did a past. Right. And my examples could have been better chosen for the audience. But that led me to this book, which I mentioned in passing when we were talking about my bands on your other podcast, and here we are.
It was after folks that listened to that episode that you should go look at the nakedlyexaminedmusic.com page and listen to it. But yeah, the context, it was actually after we were done and I was trying to squeeze a few more minutes out of you before you had to go back to your real job. And I tried giving a quick version of the aesthetics lecture that I give every single time we have an aesthetics episode of some sort or another. And I didn't do it particularly well and you didn't really buy it. But part of the upshot was whenever you do aesthetic theorizing, as we have, for instance, Kant, within the last year, we did an episode on Kant's aesthetic theory. And Kant is one of the main targets of Bourdieu here, insofar as he has an axe to grind, in that he says that you shouldn't be doing theory without analyzing where the theory is coming from in terms of your place in social space. In other words, Kant was being a snob. He was channeling aristocratic values. And that doesn't mean that you just dismiss everything he has to say and say, ah, he's just being a snob. Like, you can still pay attention to the content, but the picture is not complete unless you get a sociological picture of where theorizing in general and theorizing about taste in particular is coming from.
The basic idea is that these aesthetic judgments are going to be the result of and a means of establishing social distinctions, you know, between, let's say, the upper class, the middle class, and the lower class. So what you like and what you don't like is an indicator of where you stand in the hierarchy. And by sort of being conditioned into one sort of kind of taste or another, say for popular culture or for something that's more refined, you are being conditioned to take a certain role in society, or it's a means of establishing your role.
And this book basically has a whole bunch of data supporting that.
Yes, right. It's a survey. It's a survey by questionnaire carried out in 1963 first, and then 1967 to 68 on a sample of 1,217 people. So the parts that I was able to skim over are where he gets in depth into the survey itself. But the sort of the overall thrust is interesting in that, yes, you've got this thing between the upper and the lower class where fine art is a way of excluding people that don't have the educational background to understand it.
Part of the point of this is it's not just that you need an educational background to understand that art. In fact, I think it's kind of the point that that's not what's going on. It's just that the same sorts of sociological conditions that will lead you to have a really good education will also lead you to have been conditioned to liking these sorts of things. It's not that I need to understand a lot in order to prefer classical music over rock music. It's not that I need to have a greater knowledge of music theory. And a lot of it's just implicit, he says. I just have to have been conditioned in certain ways.
Well, Seth, give us an opening statement here.
So the key thrust was that this was intended to be a sociological and empirical study, mm-hmm. which demonstrated that in addition to just questioning people about what their preferences were as far as cultural artifacts, he also got a fair amount of demographic information about them. And he had a classification where some people were working class and some were bourgeois and, you know, some were this and some were that. And there were distinctions in French terms in here that I didn't exactly follow. But the idea was he felt there was statistical correlation between preferences expressed by people who gathered together in certain social classes and who had, in turn, similar educations for the same sorts of things. So that's really the point of the book, is to say, if you're working class, you're going to prefer Mozart over Mahler, or, you know, whatever all the various things were, and certain popular singers over certain others, and certain types of, I think food might have been included in this as well, but
yep.
So that's kind of the empirical piece of it. And then what I would say is the more speculative or philosophical aspect is that he suggests that this is essentially the inculcation of ideology in some respect, and that education functions to perpetuate these cultural distinctions and reinforce them because it's not symmetric. It's not like working class have their taste and that's good for them and it's not, you know, nobody else cares, and upper class have their taste and that's good for them. And it's that there's a hierarchy in place where it's okay for people with high culture tastes, as it were, to not like low culture, but it's not okay for low culture people not to like high culture. So low culture people typically have to find excuses for why they don't get into it. They don't understand it, or they don't care for it. Whereas it's perfectly fine for somebody who loves Proust to say Punch and Judy is ridiculous. And I know I wanted
it's
to drop
disgusting.
I wanted to drop Punch and Judy just because it's always seems to be a reference for low culture. And I bet you there aren't 5% of our listeners who have any idea what the fuck Punch and Judy is.
Let's do a survey of that.
I think it's the middle. So those distinctions you made, Seth, were the bourgeois, petit bourgeois, and then the working class. So roughly corresponding to upper class, middle class, and lower class.
But then he contrasts it with the professionals. So the bourgeois are more the business types, whereas the professionals are like doctors, and then the educated class. And then I think he just considers straight up rich people, right? Apart from the bourgeois as well.
Well, these are distinctions I'm not clear on. I mean, the tripartite classical distinction the bourgeois are the upper classes, and then the petit bourgeois are the sort of merchant classes. I don't know if professionals now fall into that category. Do you know for him who he's gathering where? Or
yeah, I thought those were two different things. I mean, I guess the overall, that it's the upper and lower class, but then within, so he says the definition of cultural nobility, this is page 2, is the stake in a struggle which has gone on unceasingly from the 17th century to the present days between groups differing in their ideas of culture and of the legitimate relation to culture and to works of art, and therefore differing in the conditions of acquisition of which these dispositions are the product. And that the struggle is between those, the educated, so like the scholar types, and the hereditary nobility, that this is still in a time, you know, France in particular had a lot more of, you know, we might think here the upper classes are the bourgeois, but in France, even in 1979, I think there were still like the bourgeois in some way are crass in a way that true nobility is not. I think there's more distinctions that are explicitly acknowledged and played upon in the French society that he's coming from than we have here. And that's part of what makes it hard for us to figure out.
The nobles themselves are not. Ultimately, the most cultured members will be the scholars,
yeah,
according to the whole standard of the what he'll call the pure pleasure, or this, the pure aesthetic. Because the courtiers and the nobility, they might be sensitive to trends or something like that, and even to the trends of high culture. But there's a difference between that and being actually knowledgeable. Yeah, I don't know how all these fine-grained distinctions work out in terms of the, like I said, the larger tripartite distinction. I don't know what gets grouped where, but there are all sorts of finer distinctions to make.
There is actually a really helpful chart in the edition we're looking at. It's page 17. You know, I was very skeptical. I wasn't understanding what these different distinctions of society were in France, and I wasn't understanding why well-tempered Clavier was, you know, was high culture and Blue Danube was low culture.
But they're all high culture to us.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so it's like, it's all classical. I don't know. That's class. You look at this chart, and it's the page of the book that actually just drove home the empirical basis of what he was doing. And I was like, oh, it doesn't matter whether I believe him, whether I'm skeptical of the subjective distinctions he's making between these different works. When you look at the empirical data, there's three pieces that he's described. One is sort of high culture, one is middle brow, and one is low. And he's showing you sort of algorithmically how it breaks down very, very predictably by class. And so I'll just sort of work through it here. The way he's got it, the cultural nobility, the ones with the most class, as it were, according to these charts, are higher education teachers and art producers themselves. The next tier is secondary teachers. The next tier down from that is private sector executives and engineering professions. The next tier is public sector executives. The next tier is industrial and commercial employers, then cultural intermediaries, art craftsmen, then primary teachers, then medical social services, then technicians, whatever that is, then junior commercial executives and secretaries, and we're going lower and lower here, now junior administrative executives, then clerical and commercial employees, then craftsmen and shopkeepers, then domestic servants, and at the bottom is manual workers. So those are the brackets that he's using. And as obscure as some of those seem to me, you look at the data and there's just this almost perfect reflection that if you're a manual worker, you have very little familiarity with a well-tempered clavier, whereas if you're a higher education teacher and art producer, you have maximum familiarity with it. And at what he considers the bottom of the spectrum, Blue Danube, the higher education teachers and art producers like don't like that. And the manual workers, like, they love it. It's their favorite. And the graphs are just astonishing.
Yes, the one that you skipped over was the professions. That was above private sector executives and engineers, but below secondary teachers. So doctors and lawyers are not quite as cultured as teachers, but more so than any of those crass bourgeois.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought we'd take a little while to get here, but there's an interesting point that you mentioned that's called out by this graph, Tim. So well-tempered clavier, it's linear from one end to the other as to preference. And then Blue Danube is the complete opposite, but also linear. But in the middle, Rhapsody in Blue has almost like a bell curve where it's disliked almost equally by the high and the low, but enjoyed by the by the middle group. he goes on about that at length, but it's an interesting. I will take screenshots of this and post to Twitter while we're so that fans who can look up our Twitter feed and they can see the pictures we're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's because the point he makes is that the petit bourgeois, the ones in the middle, are unsure of what they're supposed. They sort of know that they're trying to imitate bourgeois taste, right? So they know that they're supposed to like certain things and they're not supposed to like other things, but they aren't exactly sure of what those things are. So the higher in the class you go, the more they're going to do this exclusionary thing where they know, oh, Blue Danube, that's for the uncultivated. And well-tempered clavier, yes.
Can we just say country music instead of Blue Danube? Can we just say that?
Yeah. is that well, like you said, everything is high culture to us. I mean, it's hard to make those distinctions, but yeah, you could. But yeah. So yeah, oh, country music, that's for a certain kind of person. And
Petulia Clark was the one popular music example. Petulia Clark and Jacques Brel. I think Petulia Clark was like the low class and Jacques Brel was middle brow. Those were the two that I got.
Yeah, so I don't know what counts as middle brow today. The thing that might confuse us about what category does it go in. So the lower classes will just, they'll go for what they like naively. They're just responding to preferences, whereas the middle and the upper classes are responding to.
I would say the middle brow is classic rock, that like my brother-in-law only likes the Beatles and Dylan and the Rolling Stones, like things that have been consecrated.
I don't know, though. You don't get any social standing out of that.
The thing that interests me about and why this chart I found so helpful in sort of crystallizing what he was saying is I think from society to society and era to era, what falls in any one of those categories is going to vary, right? And so it almost doesn't matter what content you're talking about. The idea is if you're talking about a particular class, the people with more cultural capital are going to like things at this higher tier in a very predictable way that's sort of algorithmically the opposite of what people with lower cultural capital are going to think about that thing. And so the way to decide what's middle brow, high brow, or low brow isn't to sort of make a subjective judgment about it, but just do a survey like this and see where it falls.
Yeah, I think today it's clear with something like fiction, for instance, where you've got, you know, these plot-driven and really generally badly written, because I've looked at a lot of them now, but, you know, thrillers, for instance, right? So novels that you can just pick up and consume and that have no interest in anything aesthetic. Like, it's completely about giving you, you know, a feeling of suspense. And then hardcore literary fiction, which is really, really demanding. And in some cases, you know, like I read Marilynne Robinson's, I think it's called Housekeeping. There's basically almost no plot to it, but a lot of beautiful writing. And I really enjoy beautiful writing, but it was getting a little bit rough going there with no plot, right? So, I mean, especially these days, we're all, you know, no matter what our education, we're conditioned to wanting that kind of what Kant would call the charms. We got to have some level of that in our entertainments. And then in the middle, you have sorts of, I don't know if Gone Girl falls into this category, but it's, you know, just looking at it, it's a very well-written novel. It has some literary aspiration to it, but it's also very plot-driven. So you have sort of hybrid and very clearly marketed at upper middle class. And if you talk to your upper middle class friends, these are a lot of people who have read this novel, for instance, Gone Girl. They're not necessarily going to be reading Don DeLillo or something like that, something that's harder. Maybe Jonathan Franzen is a better example because he's definitely, like Corrections, for instance. He's definitely a literary novelist, but he's writing for a broader audience. So anyway, just to get a concrete example down.
You can do this in a lot of different mediums. So in movies, I look at somebody like Iñárritu, you know, who had The Revenant this year and Birdman last year, and they sort of present as these artistic visions, but just going by my Twitter feed, are absolutely reviled by the people I consider having the most cultural capital, right? And like, I run hot and cold with the guy, but I don't hate him the way critics that I respect despise him and just think he's the cheesiest thing ever. I've been trying to work out why that is.
That is a great question, because I just rewatched Birdman the other night with my wife, and we have good friends who hate that movie. And I was like, how can you hate it?
Yeah. Well, were they hating it from the low end or from the high end?
That's right. Well, that's a good question. Probably from the high end.
Interesting question. This particular couple was coming at it from both sides. Actually, they're both highly educated, but not culturally so to speak.
But that was one of the cool things was, when you look at this generationally, somewhere he says, like, by a simple dialectical inversion, the next generation will despise what the previous generation thought was great. And that's partly why upper classes, why the ones at the top of the scale could, in some cases, embrace low culture things. Now, they can't really embrace low culture things. They end up being hipsters. They end up making it ironic. They can't actually take it seriously. Yeah. They bring it into some second order, but it still, at least nominally, is no, we have to return. So even if you read this book and were like, I'm not going to be a snob anymore, or, I hate those damn artistic snobs. I'm going to reject that. And I'm going to really like the music of the people, the blues, the deep blues. Then you end up being a special kind of blues snob.
Well, the point there too is that when you make that return, you're still privileging form over function and content, right? The aesthetic disposition is that, and we'll get into this more, is that disinterested interest in form, and you can do that with anything, right? You could take the thriller. For the uncultivated person, it's just a thrill ride. They can't put it down. But you could take a completely different angle with that and come at it from and of course, I'm sure there are a lot of college courses now which do this. They probably assign only Pulp Fiction, but you read it from this other level on you. So you haven't escaped this aesthetic point of view.
Yeah, and there's some fascinating bits in there when he starts talking about movies where people in different, you know, classes who go to movies just as frequently as one another, but the more educated ones, they focus on they can name the directors of all the movies, whereas the less educated can't, even though they've seen the same movies and the same number of movies with the same frequency. So there's this quote that just stuck with me, where some only see a, quote, Western starring Burt Lancaster, others discover an early John Sturges or the latest Sam Peckinpah. In identifying what is worthy of being seen and the right way to see it, they are aided by their whole social group, which guides and reminds them with its have you seen and you must see, and by the whole corporation of critics mandated by the group to produce legitimate classifications and the discourse necessarily accompanying any artistic enjoyment worthy of the name.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the thing that would kind of screw that up now, if we're trying to bring this into the present day, which we sort of should, I think, as we're going through this, is, of course, the greater opportunity for autodidacticism, which he does have quite a bit to say about the autodidact as somebody that learns these things on their own outside of their social group, where they were raised. Their actual educational capital would not support this, but they manage just through interest and exposing themselves, you know, to go learn the names of all the film directors or something, despite the fact that that's not the cool, you know, maybe they and their friends do it. So they build their own little social group. But I think he brings that up mostly to say how that group is still excluded by sort of the ones with the, with the actually greater cultural capital and background and in, how does he say, really it's a breeding in their upbringing.
So that's on page 24. There's legitimate autodidacticism and then illegitimate. And then the legitimate is if you're a professor and you make forays into other fields, that's okay. But you got to have some sort of title. You got to have some sort of credential to be taken seriously. The essentially contradictory phrase legitimate autodidacticism is intended to indicate the difference in kind between the highly valued extracurricular culture of the holder of academic qualifications and the illegitimate extracurricular culture of the autodidact. So, yes, knowing a lot isn't really the relevant thing, actually. You know, or at page 25, he goes on to say, you know, a degree is not a guarantee of a specific competence about culture. And that's not really the point. It's not that you need to know, you know, a lot. Like, again, you have some great knowledge about film or literature or something to know what you're supposed to value. You can pick up that and you can do it almost unconsciously. you can know what's supposed to be high culture and supposed to be low culture and respond to that and be a quote unquote cultured person with very, very little actual scholarly or academic knowledge.
One of his main targets in here is this ideology of charisma, that taste is a gift of nature, which I think is the thing that is coming from the hereditary aristocracy, that even within educational institutions, he says there's sort of a contempt for doing it by the book, for what you actually learn. And I've encountered this myself just in, I was almost irritated by when I got to college and there were, I just felt like in grade school that you were just graded on how smart you were. And so I felt like since I kind of, you know, tested well early on, I got this sense of, man, I don't have to prove myself through actually fulfilling requirements of particular teachers to learn particular things. It's just, it's my nature. I'm a smart person, so I should do well in this. And so when I actually got to a level of education where you just couldn't bullshit your way through it, it was actually kind of surprising. So that's my own little snobbish parallel.
Oh, that level of education exists? I never encountered that level of education.
Well, that's because you weren't a philosophy major.
Yeah. So.
I did find that, like, that at the college level, if it was like a Great Books of the Far East course, if I was doing Taoism or something through that, I could just bullshit my way through a paper. You know, of course I read it, but like that you could just say something that's kind of deep, say something that's insightful, and they say, oh wow, that's wonderful. But in philosophy, there was some sort of objectivity that was developed or some standard that you could objectively not fulfill, even if you were smart and doing the reading, and just like there was a particular mastery that you had to have. So that will be a surprise to many people that supposedly philosophy is the thing academically that is harder to bullshit.
It was certainly harder for students who had us as TAs to bullshit.
That's right. In your logic course.
Oh, God.
Now, before we go further, let's stop and talk about our sponsors. The first of which is The Great Courses. You're probably familiar with their giant library of lecture series taught by top professors. It's a very good idea to include some input by professionals in addition to listening to the kind of stuff that we talk about. The podcast and the academic thing complement each other very well. And we're very excited to tell you about The Great Courses new video learning service, The Great Courses Plus, which gives you unlimited access to a very big library covering philosophy, covering history, politics, music, art, religion, science, mindfulness, much, much more. And because we really want you to try The Great Courses Plus, we're giving our listeners a special chance to watch their popular course, The Great Ideas of Philosophy, and the hundreds of other ones, absolutely free. Now, The Great Ideas of Philosophy is taught by Professor Daniel Robinson. This week, I watched lecture number 59, Aesthetics, Beauty Without Observers, which really fills out the historical picture of the kind of thing that Bourdieu is trying to situate sociologically. It starts with Plato's Symposium, talks about Hume's On the Standard of Taste, which is not one that we've covered, as well as Edmund Burke that we did, gives you a nice little refresher on Kant, and takes you to G.E. Moore, whom we also did not cover, but which is a sort of predictable outgrowth of the Kantian view that we've described. On Moore's view, the beautiful world would be better than the non-beautiful world, right? Beauty is in itself a good, and so this would be true even if there were no people to observe it, thus beauty without observers. And that's, of course, just one of the many, many interesting things in this lecture series and in the library as a whole. The Great Courses Plus is offering our listeners a chance to stream hundreds of their courses, including this one, The Great Ideas of Philosophy, which is a $530 value for free when you go to thegreatcoursesplus, that's plus.com/PEL. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL.
Hey, I wanted to go back to that note real quick, the point that Wes and Tim were talking about earlier around the enjoyment of a thing versus the discussion of a thing, you know, saying, oh, this is a great John Ford or this is a pre-Preston Sturgis or whatever. Isn't part of the mechanism that he's describing here is that, in fact, unless you're in a certain place in the hierarchy, or maybe not for anybody who's in the hierarchy, a pure enjoyment of something just isn't even permitted. You're either reacting to it, or in the case of that petit bourgeois central thing, you have to articulate some kind of familiarity with it. So there's never the ability to just have an aesthetic experience or enjoy something culturally, because either you don't and yet you feel like you have to respond to that lack of enjoyment, or you are aspiring to be the kind of person that does from that middle ground. Is that not part of what's going on as well?
Well, can we go to that actual page? It's page 28. What you're mentioning here is one of the most important quotes in the reading. So at the beginning of the top of page 28, such competence is not necessarily So he's thinking of cultural competence here, you know, the ability to make these distinctions between high and low. Such competence is not necessarily acquired by means of the quote-unquote scholastic labors in which some cinephiles or jazz freaks indulge. For example, transcribing film credits onto catalog cards. Most often it results from the unintentional learning made possible by a disposition acquired through domestic or scholastic inculcation of legitimate culture. Let me just point out again that this inculcation does not mean necessarily learning a great deal analytically about something. It can just be learning what's supposed to be good and what's supposed to not be good. This transposable disposition, armed with a set of perceptual and evaluative schemes that are available for general application, inclines its owner towards other cultural experiences and enables him to perceive, classify, and memorize them differently. Where some only see a Western starring Burt Lancaster, others discover an early John Sturges or the latest Sam Peckinpah. In identifying what is worthy of being seen and the right way to see it, they are aided by their whole social group. Okay, this has already been read, and then the whole corporation of critics and so on. So, yeah. So I'm actually a little confused now.
Well, I think part of what he's saying is that, you know, this is inculcated into you by partly what you get through osmosis just in your home environment if you're in the right class, but also through your educational institutions. It's not just that they're teaching you specific things about movies or books or music. They're teaching you a way of cataloging and classifying the world and cultural objects in the world. And by so doing, you are classifying yourself as the type of person who knows how to do that sort of thing. And a few pages earlier than that, there's this thing that stood out to me where it says, activities as alien to the explicit demands of the institution, this is an educational institution, as keeping a diary, wearing heavy makeup, theater going or going dancing, writing poems or playing rugby, can thus find themselves inscribed in the position allotted within the institution as a tacit demand constantly underlined by various mediations. So the idea is it's not just what you're explicitly being taught in school, it's you're being taught how to be and how to consume culture as well as other stuff, and that all of that is mostly a way of marking yourself out from other people right. Who don't know how to do that.
Well put.
Yeah, very well put. And there's a great follow-up to that. Were you on page 25 or so, Tim?
Yeah, it's 25 at the very bottom.
Oh, the sentence right before that. The official differences produced by academic classifications tend to produce or reinforce real differences by inducing in the classified individuals a collectively recognized and supported belief in the differences, thus producing behaviors that are intended to bring real being into line with official being. That's the connection between, we see the educational institution here, him describing the educational institution as this mechanism. The educational institution doesn't create those classes, but it defines them and reinforces them and indoctrinates us. The question is, where do those official differences come from? Because they're not generated or manufactured by the educational system.
Yeah, and I think he's going to be discussing the answer to that, right? Why does a certain kind of taste line up with one class and not with another? And I think that we're going to get the answer to that question as we go forward.
I just want to make the point that the educational institutions, as he describes them, are just mechanisms that do the work. They're not actually the things that generate the ideology or the differences themselves.
Well, it sounds like he's going to say that class, certain economic, you know,
exactly,
material conditions of living are going to ultimately generate these distinctions. And then
we'll end up swimming back towards Adorno on this one. But it's essentially, yes, the class system that's created by capitalism, right? That's going to.
And that'll has certain kinds of, I would call them psychological effects that lead to a certain kind of aesthetic way of being.
I found Bourdieu refreshingly un-Marxist in certain ways, that he, as a sociologist, is more sensitive to the complexities, so it's not just the rich versus the poor or the bourgeois versus the working class, that there's all these very contingent historical transitions. You know, I was talking about between generations, for instance, or this change, this struggle between the newly educated and the hereditary nobility is something that is playing itself at a particular place and time. It is not just sort of a function of that's just the way class works or something like that. It's less simple than what we were seeing in the Adorno.
Going back to what you were saying before, Mark, about, you know, the, what were you saying, the charisma or something, they're running through all of this. There's the working class, which is, has this naive appreciation of art where everything's like literal, taste is literal, right? Like, you know, when you're looking at a painting, you're thinking about the colors. When you're eating food, it's like, how filling is it? As opposed to how elegantly presented is it to me? And as you rise up the ranks of cultural capital, but also just, you know, social class, the idea is you're marking yourself off from that. You, basically, you've got the leisure, you've got the time to invest in thinking about all this stuff in a different way that's less related to the literal tastes. And that part of what he only says this explicitly a couple of times in the book, but the general sense that I got from it was that what's going on here is if you are a different class, hey, you want to signify, you want to signal to everybody, hey, I'm this different class, but you also want to justify to yourself that you actually deserve it, right? And so there's this thing that comes through of like, oh, I have these sorts of tastes that other people don't. I'm one of the chosen ones. Therefore, my position in society is earned, you know, and it's right that I am here. Like you said, he's not all that Marxist, so he doesn't come right out and say it all that often, but it's the subtext that's running through everything he's saying.
Yeah, we should say sort of overall, he's a sociologist. I listened to another podcast sort of going into his general method that I'll link folks to, but he had a philosophical background. He sort of started in philosophy, but then really for a lot of the reason that people reject philosophy.
Thought better of it?
Well, he wanted to do something that was more practical. So he saw sociology, what he was doing, not merely as scientific analytic, but as having a social purpose. So even if he's not beating you over the head with it all the time in the way that Adorno and Horkheimer were doing in the last essay, he really is trying to, you know, pretty obviously undermine this oppression of the working class or these, you know, this ideology of charisma, all these things he sees as signs of something that is causing human suffering, and that it's his position as sociologist to point these things out so we can better understand each other, I guess.
Yeah. One of the connections here between the material conditions and the particular tastes has to do with signifying your immunity to necessity. So once you are in a position, you know, economically where you don't have to worry about making a living, you can start doing things like wasting time, taking walks, you know, the whole idea of like, I'm going to exercise, go to the gym. Whereas, you know, for millennia, labor has meant exercise, right? And who would do that in their spare time? Who would need to do that? So there's a link between that and then the pure aesthetic, the Kantian aesthetic of disinterest, of a withdrawal from charm and gratification and all those things, which are sort of indications of your immunity to the need for that.
Because all that other stuff is perceived as vulgar. And so this is, you know, the line that I like is, in matters of taste more than anywhere else, all determination is negation. And tastes are perhaps first and foremost distastes, disgust provoked by horror or visceral intolerance, quote, sick making of the tastes of others.
Yep.
I read that and I feel terrible because that's, right. I am that way, right? Like, I mean, there's certain pop music, certain sitcoms that I just find insipid, and they do make, you know, it's maybe not quite as visceral as making me sick, but I, you know, I do feel kind of disgust for it. I was like, oh, how could anyone like that? It's so cheap. It's so cheesy. It's so obvious what it's doing.
Right. The disgust is based on how manipulative it is, how quick it is to try to please you without any sort of subterfuge, right? It's just going to ring your bell. And there's something offensive about that, I think rightly.
Right. So I've always felt like I was responding to the work itself, right? I was like, oh, that work thinks so little of me. How dare it? But what I'm picking up from Bordeaux is, no, I'm actually reacting. I'm othering myself to the people. I'm saying, oh, I'm not like the people who are fooled by this stuff, those idiots.
Well, I've had actually the experience with certain kinds of music, like I eventually like it, but only when I can get out of my mind the people who introduced me to it, like people in the dorm floor that like listen to REM or Pearl Jam or whatever, like, oh, these bands are so stupid because these people I didn't like at the time. And like, oh, it was only when I could get past that, or maybe it's a matter of even forgetting about the personalities of the musicians themselves, that you can appreciate it in a way that makes sense to you or something. But it's all, you can't escape snobbery, I think, as far as Bordeaux is concerned.
Oh, yeah. For me, it took me years to appreciate Neil Young just because my older brother and all his stoner friends who I hated loved him. So, like, I just couldn't hear it.
We shouldn't ignore the fact that there's a sorry to segue from Neil Young back to Kant, but the more fundamental idea is that judgments of beauty, an aesthetic disposition, it's meant to essentially be freeing. It's meant to, and this is Schopenhauer as well, it's meant to free you from the heteronomy of the will. It's meant to free you from being enslaved to your passions and the world of necessity and animal pleasure and gratification. What's offensive, supposedly, is a work of art that's, instead of doing that, is just actually enslaving you. That's why we object to something being manipulative, or we reject to sitcoms that are just too obvious and have no other aesthetic component to them and no real wit or something like that. I don't know that he's so much arguing against the Kantian idea as just saying that it's sort of socially situated, so that we have to bear in mind the sense in which this idea of a pure aesthetic gaze and a Kantian aesthetic as distinguished from gratification bears out a distinction between classes, between material conditions, and so on and so forth.
I do like the fact that at the end, so this is this postscript after the conclusion, toward a vulgar critique of pure critiques. And that's where he explicitly, you know, more brings in Kant and Schopenhauer and the other philosophers that we've read, and Derrida later. And it's, you know, makes sure to say, look, it would be just as much a mistake to dismiss everything Kant has to say just because of its aristocratic origins as it would be to just ignore those origins and embrace what he has to say. He doesn't really give you what the solution is. It's maybe take it with a grain of salt. Take it with a sociological background intact.
I mean, the question is, if in a classless society, right, if there could be such a thing, would all these kinds of distinctions collapse? And then where would they collapse to? Would there cease to be a distinction between mere gratification and aesthetic appreciation of form if they weren't grounded in class distinctions? I tend to think they wouldn't simply go away, that they can be used as markers of class distinction and that they can take on in a way more importance because of it, and maybe even have 90% of their significance defined by that. I don't think the distinctions themselves are simply artifacts of class.
Although I'm realizing now, since you're mentioning the postscript, he does say what I was saying before explicitly. He says, the opposition between the tastes of nature and the tastes of freedom introduces a relationship which is that of the body to the soul, between those who are only natural and those whose capacity to dominate their own biological nature affirms their legitimate claim to dominate social nature. So he was being more explicit about this than I remembered.
So he characterizes, I think we had gotten to page 28, characterizes sort of what makes up this upper class disposition as the aesthetic disposition. He says, any legitimate work tends, in fact, to impose the norms of its own perception and tacitly defines as the only legitimate mode of perception the one which brings into play a certain disposition and a certain competence. I guess there's two things going on there. For one, when you get enough education, art becomes a certain special way of experiencing things. Whereas he says, the uneducated, the lower classes, it's just like if you play music that's kind of not entirely consonant, if it's at dissonant at all, most people will just be like, ah, that's ugly. Ah, I don't want to hear that. Well, that's the uneducated thing. Once you've attained the aesthetic disposition, then you can more dispassionately like, oh, that's kind of interesting. It's not just a matter of what hurts my ears and hurts my eyes. Are the colors pretty?
Yes, you are trained to not respond immediately to your instinctual reaction. Is it pleasurable or is it not pleasurable? You take a sort of meta-level view of it. In the same way, when he talks about pictures later on, if you're looking at a picture of a horrible war scene, he says the lower class person will tend to judge the picture entirely by its contents. Oh, that's horrible. And there's no idea that, well, oh, this is a beautiful picture of something horrible, which is someone in up the upper classes might be inclined to, this is an interesting picture. Look at the way the photographer is used. Shadow and blood, or anyway.
Well, that's one of the other parts of his study that he goes on about at length. I think it starts around page 35, where he asks folks in the questionnaire, what subjects look photogenic? What are fitting things to have a photograph of? A picture of pebbles, a picture of a sunset, a picture of somebody's first communion, a picture of a old woman's gnarled hands.
Yeah.
And so as a summary, it was, as you would expect, the least educated, the lowest cultural capital group were just sunsets are pretty. The sentimental stuff.
No, hands exactly. Are ugly.
But it's not even that, just that the hands are ugly. It's the picture is simply of that object. So you get commentary. The respondents simply go, oh, look at, you know, it must be such and such a problem, or that must hurt, or this. There's not even that. You haven't been trained to make that move to that second level evaluation of it simply as a representation, in which case it's not about the hands exactly. It's about the formal aesthetics of the representation.
Well, in some ways, I saw the sort of naive take on it as more sophisticated in a way that instead of saying just taking the aesthetic sense, like I'm looking at a picture and so I have to judge it as I would a work of art, that they always thought in terms of what purpose was the photo supposed to serve. So like, yeah, that would be okay as a news photo, a photo of just little pebbles. Like, what the hell is the point of that? I'm not going to put that up in my living room. It's not cool enough for that.
Although some people said it could be pretty if it was in color.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
The point is that at a certain class level, the content of the representation is important.
Yep.
In other words, the subject. Mm-hmm. Why would you think that is pretty? Whereas then you get into the middle class, the petit bourgeois, whatever, and they think, well, anything could be the subject if it's treated artistically or whatever.
Actually, that's only at the highest level. The petit bourgeois, I think, were the pretentious ones to say, oh, a sunset, that's not a good subject for a painting because that's too cliche.
Oh,
whereas when you got the most educated, then those people were like of the opinion that anything could be okay. So they would say rocks are okay, but also the sunset and the first communion are okay, whereas the middle group wouldn't say that at all.
Sunset is ironically okay.
When I was a working class, a sunset was beautiful. Then I became petit bourgeois, and the sunset was no longer beautiful. And then I became whatever, the landed gentry, and the sunset was once again beautiful.
This is reminding me, I was just a couple weeks ago down in Austin, Texas for South by Southwest, and it's bluebonnet season. So as you're driving around the outskirts of Austin, there are just fields and fields full of bluebonnets, and they only bloom for a little while, but it's just like it's blue as far as the eye can see. And the guy that was driving me to the airport said, oh yeah, there's a tradition now of, you know, when it's bluebonnet season, you come and you drop your kids in the field and you have someone take their picture. And so, of course, I instantly went to Google image search and just typed in bluebonnet children. And there are pages and pages of this stuff that you can see. I guess I have the aesthetic disposition because I was looking at all of those and they just seemed horrifyingly vulgar to me. It's just, I mean, it's because it's random and it makes no sense. It's just these children in a field of flowers. And they were obviously, they didn't make their own way there. They were just deposited there. It's very bizarre. I highly recommend, if you want to see where you fall on this spectrum, go do a Google image search for kids in bluebonnet fields and see how they make you feel.
Oh, Tim. I live in
Austin. Seth lives in Austin.
I live in Austin. And I have for 20 some odd years. And if you want to have that experience, all you have to do is friend me on Facebook.
Do you get them in your feed constantly?
Everybody. It's not just the kids. Dogs, selfies.
Yes. We have, when I live there, we have our dog in blue bonnets. We have pictures of that.
I'm looking at these now online. Yes, these are horrifying.
The humanity.
I feel less alone now.
Well, let's explain why it's horrifying, though, in greater detail. I think this will be a really good example.
Okay, I'm listening. I'm not allowed to.
I was counting on you to
participate.
Do
it. No, I'm not allowed to participate in this conversation.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, this is the finding it horrifying is one of the things to be overcome to get to the next level of the dialectic.
Well, only if you're really an asshole.
What he says as the highest level, this, you know, that anything could be the subject of a painting, this sort of John Cage approach to the aesthetic disposition is something that you don't even need art. It's, you know, Duchamp, that you could just look at a urinal and something and you could take the aesthetic disposition and find the beauty in it, or it doesn't even have to have beauty. You stop even thinking in terms of beauty. It's just more aesthetic more generally. But then at some point in the text, I think he quotes an artist. I'm not sure where the quote is, but that itself is just a pretension that real artists, even somebody like John Cage and Duchamp, do not have. That's like a pretentious pseudo-intellectual people that pretend to like the urinal and pretend to appreciate Duchamp actually think, oh yes, anything is art. Like, no, actual artists don't think that. That was a one-off aesthetic joke, or, you know, it was an advance in art at some point, but no. So that too is to be overcome.
So this puts me in mind, we did an episode on aesthetics back in the day on Nelson Goodman. And remember when we were talking to Jay about What is that horrible art that hangs in like doctor's offices and hotel rooms?
Kincaid.
Now that strikes me as offensive, and it inspires in me that reaction that you're describing, much more so than, say, pictures of kids in blue bonnets.
So I think we can, we have to jump back to the postscript to really get at what's offensive about the blue bonnets, but objectively offensive. So page 486, the first full paragraph, discussed at the facile, the refusal of what is easy in the sense of simple and therefore shallow and cheap, because it is easily decoded and culturally undemanding, naturally leads to the refusal of what is facile in the ethical or aesthetic sense of everything which offers pleasures that are too immediately accessible and so discredited as childish or primitive, as opposed to the deferred pleasures of legitimate art, unquote. So I think that really, I don't know if we can say it even better than that. I mean, that gives you a very clear and I think very good explanation of what it is we might find objective about the children in blue bonnets pictures. It's this idea of the cheapness of it, the lack of demand. He also goes on to say, giving the spectator the sense of being treated like any Tom, Dick, or Harry who can be seduced by tawdry charms, which invite him to regress to the most primitive and elementary forms of pleasure, whether they are passive satisfactions of the infantile taste for sweet liquids, syrupy, or the quasi-animal gratifications of sexual desire. Yeah,
okay. Really. I'm going to have to jump in here. So let's distinguish between that act as a mode of production by an artist who's intentionally trying to do that and something like people sharing pictures of their kids on Facebook or whatever. The family who hires a professional photographer to take pictures of their kids in the blue bonnet and then shares those pictures on Instagram is not subject to the same evisceration by this critique as the photographer who then takes those pictures and puts them on their profile page as an exemplar of their work.
Oh, wait a minute, though. Wait a minute.
Two different things.
Well, they're almost just as bad as each other.
I don't know, because the photographer would be rejoicing in the form.
You took a picture of your kid in your apartment and want to share that. Okay, great. We understand what the purpose of that picture is and why you would... Why would you would want to share that, even if we don't really want to see your kids? We understand that.
Yeah.
But you went through all the effort to go out to a blue bonnet field and stick your kid in the blue. What are you trying to do there? And forget about the professional photographer. Sorry, I sound like I'm accusing you of having done that, Seth. But
is it partaking in a cultural tradition of some sort?
Yeah, it's a mindless ritual, which is what offends me about it.
It is being swayed by that peer group you have been... It is definitely enforcement. It's not a formal educational official thing, but it becomes sort of like a social.
But why is it mindless ritual?
Well,
it's the blue bonnets are pretty. They come out and that's the point.
Lots of things are pretty. Go take a picture of your kid next to a pretty thing that no one else has taken a picture next to.
So the point of the paragraph I just read is that there's almost something immoral about it. It's analogous to something that's unethical.
That's putting a pretty high standard on people.
No, I'm not agreeing with it necessarily. I'm just saying what I'm trying to get at what's really entailed in this judgment. I'm not saying I necessarily endorse our...
Yeah, let's... I mean,
although even though I feel it, but I'm not...
You're come down on the side of the snobs. Come on.
Let's stop ragging on the families that do it, but continue to rag on the professional photographer who then exhibits those pictures.
Just this idea of what's undemanding, or the idea that it's... manipulating, that it's sort of just pandering to your basest desires without even this talk of childish or primitive, that it's not even calling on you as an adult.
So let me harken back a little bit to the Adorno discussion, where one of the criticisms that Adorno brought to bear was that the culture industry manufactures culture for people that doesn't challenge them. You don't want it to be too difficult to consume your art, because the whole point of art is to distract somebody from their miserable existence of repetitious work and long enough that they can get sleep and go back and do it again the next day, right? So it's about the fact that the culture industry creates art that doesn't engage people in a certain way. And it sounds like this is an echo of that.
Yeah, Adorno exactly exemplifies the kind of snob that he's objecting to. This could be seen as a response to Adorno, this whole book.
And again, I'm not sure that Bourdieu is entirely objecting to this. I mean, I know he's framing this as a critique of this. But anyway, he'll go on to say, our objection to it is that it's enslaving. It's violence. You know, he's gone to use that very word, violence. Art is supposed to be freeing. It's supposed to call out something in the free play of your imagination. And these objects are meant to heteronomize you. They're meant to simply make you drool a little bit, let's say. That's what's supposed to be offensive about these things.
Just say why that fulfills the word heteronomize. Explain your use of that term.
No, because it basically subjugates you to the object of desire. That's the heteronomy.
As opposed to autonomy. Yes, gotcha.
Instead of being autonomous, instead of being free, autonomous, independent of the object. And by the way, that's matched by the independence of form and content. So in a true work of art, the form becomes independent of the content. The aesthetic perceiver maintains their autonomy or even has their autonomy enhanced by their experience of the object. And so the ethical parallel there, right, is that the autonomy of making decisions according to the good, according to reason, although in the case of art, it's even more freeing in the sense that it's not the rules of reason you're obeying, it's your own rules. The artist makes the rules. So that's even more freeing in a sense. So the objection here is that instead of doing the very thing that an art object is supposed to do, it tries to subjugate you. I find it interesting that he uses this word violence frequently in the postscript. So I think we ought to take that idea seriously, not just dismiss it as snobbery, you know.
No, I'm okay with that. Tim, I'm going to throw this back at you. How does this proliferation of repetitious and artistically uninteresting pictures of children in bluebonnet fields subjugate you? How does that mechanism work?
I'm trying not to be flip here. I'm trying to actually examine my visceral disgust.
It's attempting to subjugate you. It's not actually subjugating you.
Well, I don't know. I felt pretty impressed. The way I first brought this up is part of what this Bourdieu book did was it made me feel skeptical of that initial impulse of mine. Like, I'm just trying to separate myself from the herd and say I have, you know, some aesthetic disposition that makes me better than them. And I should be rightly skeptical of that. But at the same time, I have this feeling. And I guess what it comes from is just this sense that I feel sorry, in a way, for anybody who hired a professional photographer. I feel sorry for the kids. I feel sorry for the people who spent money on it. I feel sorry for the photographer who probably had grander ambitions, and yet this is how he's paying the rent. I think I used the phrase mindless repetition before. It feels mindless to me, and that's what bothers me about it. It's like, yes, kids are pretty and fields are pretty, but if you see the same thing 1,000 times over and over again, it loses some of its prettiness. Mm. It loses its ability to affect you in the same way. Music is my favorite art form, right? And music in all genres evolves. And one of the reasons it evolves is you can only do the same tricks a certain number of times before they lose their power to affect you anymore. So I think it's the sameness, it's the repetition. And going back to that other word, it's facile. And all of those things depress me. I want more from art and from my fellow man.
Well, that seems an excellent point to end our first half on. So thank you for listening. You can get part two. You don't have to wait until next week. You could just go get the citizen version of this right now at partiallyexaminedlife.com. Make your little contribution, become a PEL citizen, and there you go. And that will distinguish you from the herd. All right, good night.
Good night.